University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Our region has talent, but you probably already knew about that. We send our finest to the Top Chef contests, to Hollywood, and yes, to RuPaul's Drag Race. Later this morning, Jarek Hoffer, a.k.a. Jinx Monsoon, will be in. As you just heard in our newscast, the majority of Seattle City Council members say they want to shut down the homeless encampment Nicholsville on September 1st. Mayor Mike McGinn says he won't oppose them. Over the past few years, the city of Seattle's talked about finding alternatives to a camp or at least another permanent location, but nothing has really happened. Now the landowner adjacent to Nicholsville suing the city for loss of property value. Perhaps that spurred this action. Tim Harris is co-founder of the newspaper Real Change, which covers issues of homelessness. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Were you surprised, Tim, by the city council's decision to shut down Nicholsville?
Not entirely. I didn't see it coming quite that decisively and that soon. But I did think that the legislation that Nick had introduced...
Nick Licata had introduced to...
Try to find an alternative and legalize encampments on public and private property. I thought that legislation was probably a long shot. So I thought this was coming, but not quite so quickly.
As I just mentioned earlier, the city has batted around a number of possibilities and nothing has really come through. From your perspective, what should the city's priority be when it comes to providing services for the homeless?
Well, you know, there's two tracks. There is the long-term housing first sort of solutions that move people out of homelessness into housing. And then there is safety and survival tonight. I mean, there's an enormous shortage even of emergency shelter. When the one-night count happened on January 25th, 2,736 people were counted outside in King County after the shelters were filled, and that includes the emergency overflow shelters. So, you know, the tent cities meet a need. There are a lot of people out there who aren't getting into the shelter system, and they're safer in community and with some support than they are surviving in isolation. And I think that that needs to be recognized along with the importance of the longer term solutions.
Is there any kind of political capital to be gained by keeping the issue of tent cities or Nicholsville in particular in the headlines?
Well, I mean, I think it's always important to keep the issue of safety and survival tonight highlighted because it's easy to forget. There's this sort of a comfortable myth that the problem is being taken care of, that we have adequate shelter, that it's a pathway to housing. If homeless people will just go to shelter and get into housing, everything's going to be fine. And the system is very, very broken. And I think that the tent cities help to point to the brokenness of the system and the need for deeper, more structural solutions.
Well, you mentioned housing tonight, that sort of emergent issue. I have nowhere to sleep. I need safety at this very minute. But underlying, many years ago, former King County executives talked and the King County Council talked about ending homelessness in 10 years. It was one of Ron Sims' proposals. I don't think it's been quite 10 years, but ending isn't even in sight.
It's been about 7 years, and the numbers of homeless people have increased since the 10-year plan began. The number of homeless people in shelter has gone up by 7%, and the number of people counted outside after the shelters are filled in King County has gone up something like 33%. And, you know, when we see things like what's going on at the State House right now with, you know, the Senate trying to push through this austerity budget that would leave, I mean, according to the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance's estimates, if the Senate budget goes through, it would leave another 24,000 or so people homeless over the next 2 years. So, you know, those are some pretty negative trends that we're fighting against. And I don't think that the 10-year plan is quite up to addressing the deeper structural issues that are driving this.
You're talking about issues that affect more than the number of people homeless on the streets. So I want to bring it back to Nicholsville in particular. City Council says we want to close this by September 1st. There were two votes against that. One of them, as you mentioned, Council Member Licata. The council also says that it will authorize up to $500,000 from the general fund to provide services for specifically the residents of that camp. One of the questions I had to do with the sanitation and public safety issues at Nicholsville itself. Could that $500,000 be diverted to improve the conditions at this West Seattle encampment that exists?
Probably not, because that particular site is under threat of two different lawsuits. I think the time at that site is at an end, and the neighborhood's tolerance is at its limits. And the next problem is that there really isn't a structural solution for where the site can go. Nick Licata's proposal was about trying to legalize an alternative for the encampment to be able to move to public or private property. And with the failure of that ordinance to gain traction on the council, there really aren't any good alternatives for the site to move somewhere else unless it were to locate to church property, and that would be a short-term solution.
Isn't that what we've seen for the last few years?
Yeah. Well, what they've done for a while and what other tent cities have done is they rotate among church properties for periods of about 3 months. They're hosted by a succession of churches, and that tends to work out pretty well. But the whole idea behind Nicholsville was to have a place where people could have some more permanence and stability than that, and for it to be a longer-term solution. You know, that doesn't really work with the church-based
right.
hosting.
Well, what if there was, I know one of the proposals had been to renovate a Lake City fire station, I believe. Is there, when you talk about structural solution, are you talking about a permanent physical building? Or are you talking about legal structural changes?
I'm talking about legal structural changes. I'm talking about changes to land use that allow encampments to exist on public property. Right now, you know, according to the city's just the zoning laws, it's not possible to host an encampment on public property and do so legally. So that was a big part of the intent of the ordinance that was in City Council, is to create a structural fix to that and allow the city to put a parcel of land out there that actually works as a longer term location.
You mentioned that the overnight homeless count this year found close to 3,000 individuals, if I'm remembering the
right.
exact figure. About 100 people, more give or take a dozen, are in and out of this Nicholsville encampment. So it's just serving a slice of the need. Wouldn't some kind of large physical building that provided more shelter be a better solution?
Possibly, but a big part of what makes Nicholsville work and the other homeless encampments, because there's also, you know, Tent City 3, which is operated very efficiently for a number of years and been hosted by a succession of churches. There's Tent City 4 on the east side. There's Camp Unity on the east side that also operates very, very well and has a lot of community support. What these tent cities do is they offer an opportunity for self-managed community. And the history of these things, and I'm not exactly sure why, but the history of these things has been that they work well as tent communities, but when you take the model inside a building, like into a warehouse or something, it doesn't work as well. And maybe it's because you don't have the privacy of the tents. Maybe it's because people are just packed in a little bit too closely, but the model just doesn't tend to work very well indoors. And I know that when Nicholsville was at the firehouse for a little while, that was a very challenging period in terms of the sort of dynamics of the group.
Well, Tim Harris, thank you for taking a few minutes to give your perspective on what's going on. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Harris is founder of the newspaper Real Change. A majority of Seattle City Council members has asked Mayor McGinn to shut down Nicholsville Homeless Camp by September 1st. The mayor has indicated he won't oppose their request. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:18. It's been described as the most devastating disease known to man, yet it's not really all that well known. Trying to understand Huntington's disease in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evening MBA and ISM program at Seattle Pacific University, hosting an open house on Thursday, June 13th from 4:30 until 6 p.m. More information and registration is available at spu.edu/business. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world.
54 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle, expecting clouds all day, chance of showers, and a high of 65. What is the purpose of life, according to the Quran? Some thoughts on that in 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. When legendary folk singer Woody Guthrie died of a mysterious disease called Huntington's, nobody knew much about it. And decades later, Huntington's is still relatively unknown, except for people whose lives it touches. A new documentary film called Alive and Well hopes to provide a little more insight into the personal impacts of Huntington's. The film was directed by Josh Taft. He's with us today, along with executive producer Liz Weber, a Seattle business owner with a very personal connection to Huntington's disease. Thank you both for coming in. And Liz, just begs for me to ask you, what is your personal connection to Huntington's disease?
My mom had Huntington's disease. She passed away just a couple of years ago, and she inherited it from her father, who passed away in 1974 at the age of 63. My mom was 62, and I was born with a 50-50 chance of inheriting the disease.
We'll talk a little bit more about the genetics, but one thing that I think, as I mentioned, it is a disease that it's a neurological disease, but I don't think most people understand it. So maybe, Liz, since you witnessed it, you can explain to us a little bit more about what happens.
So it's got quite a wide array of symptoms, from psychological to physical. So people call it the most devastating disease known to man. And it's been described as a disease that robs people's ability to walk, talk, think, and reason.
That's a pretty wide range. They used to call this Huntington's chorea when I first heard of it. And that term comes up briefly in the film. And then I understand now it's Huntington's disease. Chorea means just involuntary movement.
Chorea is an ancient Greek word that means dance. And that's because of the involuntary movements.
So, Josh Taft, how did you get involved in making a film about this?
Well, I was at Liz's wedding 4 or 5 years now, 6 years ago, and met her mom for the first time and get to know what their situation was and what they were going through, and just had an incredible reaction to meeting her mother, and felt like I needed to do whatever I could do to help raise awareness about what she was going through.
So before you met Liz's mom, did you know anything about this disease?
Nothing more than Woody Guthrie had it, which has sort of become our mantra explaining the film, we usually start with someone saying, oh, I know that disease. That's what Woody Guthrie had. And so we try to go beyond there. You know?
Yeah, a little bit beyond that. Liz, you mentioned that your mom had it and she had inherited it. You had a 50-50 chance of having this gene yourself. And what I remember years ago was Arlo Guthrie, son of Woody Guthrie, sort of waiting to see if the disease would hit. These days, it's not sort of a waiting game necessarily. There are tests. And so you actually went and had a genetic test, right?
I did. Yes, I got tested when I was 26 years old. It's a blood test. And it tells you indefinitely whether or not you will end up developing the disease.
And you will not.
I will not.
It's 50-50 is a huge amount. There are many genetic diseases. And the thing, I guess, with this one is that the odds are so high that that's the child of somebody with the disease will have it. I mean, it's not the same as the gene that can possibly cause breast cancer that we recently heard about with Angelina Jolie. These odds are significantly greater.
They are significantly greater. And, you know, every child is got an equal chance of getting it. So just because there are two kids doesn't mean that if one tests positive, the other won't. So we've seen families where 4 out of 4 kids end up testing positive for the disease.
Now, what, Josh, you chose to do with this film instead of, I mean, you didn't tell Liz's story. Liz is executive producer, but you found, I believe it's 6 or 7 people whose lives are touched by this. And one of these people is a physician, so I'm not sure whether I count him as somebody who's mm-hmm. necessarily touched by it. These are people who are either children of or who test positive, children who test negative, spouses of. You found a wide array of people. Where did you find these folks and how did you convince them that they wanted to be on film to tell their stories?
It's a great question. And probably the sort of crux of the success of the film was oriented in finding the right people and the right balance of stories and being able to lay them out in a sequence where we expanded the understanding of Huntington's disease to the widest range possible, because that was our mission. You know, it was a delicate mission, and really Liz was the pioneer of 90% of finding those stories, finding those families, because she, you know, had heart and skin in the game, as they say, and she knew which stories would sort of ring true in the panorama we were sort of looking for.
Now, Liz, I mentioned you were a Seattle business owner. You own Cafe Vita. You own Via Tribunali. There, you know, you're sort of not what I think of as heading out into the world of executive producer of filmdom. So, is this your first film? And B, what did you know going into it?
This is my first film. And going into it, I knew that I was working with a team of really experienced people. So Josh being one of them, with a very long career directing music videos that are very familiar to people and commercials that I'm sure most people have seen. And then his partner, Cindy Gantz, who also has a long history in the film world. So I just knew that I was going to do anything I could to help them make this project happen.
So in terms of finding people whose stories would resonate, did Josh give you a, Josh, did you say, I need a person who's going to be a certain way, or I needed this age? I mean, what kind of directive? And then how did Liz go find those people?
You know, it was a very organic process. You know, we made the film over a 5-year period. So the reason that the film took that long to complete was not for any other reason than we allowed the stories to come to us to a certain degree, rather than going out and, you know, pushing and finding these stories that sort of made up our film. We allowed the sort of stories to come to us, and the ones that were the most powerful when we discovered them ended up becoming the ones we jumped out there and photographed.
One thing I was wondering is why you chose an array. Sometimes people will do a film and they'll have a central character, and any one of these people that you focus on could have held the film. So why make that decision to make it more of a quilt of stories?
Right. Great question, and happy that you asked it, because it was an instinct that I had at the beginning of the process of constructing the right way to approach trying to tell a story about a disease that basically very few people know anything about. And so immediately I came to the conclusion that the film itself should draw no conclusion, that the mission was really to deconstruct the expectation of people looking for an answer and looking for, now I understand this and I'm clear about what Huntington's is about, because nobody is clear about what Huntington's is all about, and nobody knows what these people's lives are like unless you're living it. You know, and so the attempt was really to open the window, open the door, and expose, and in a graceful and hopefully sensitive and respectful way, what the struggles are for each one of these individuals in the seven stories, and try to make them as different from one another as possible.
I think one of the stories that really struck me the most was a family in Olympia. It's told through the eyes of a wife who's, I believe her name is Kate. And, well, maybe you want to tell her story, because I think for me, that was the most unusual of the people in the film.
Well, Katie is her name, and she has a husband who has Huntington's disease. His symptoms have progressed since we shot, but he definitely was showing symptoms when we made this film. And at the time that we made this film, she also had a six-year-old son who had the juvenile form of Huntington's disease. And she also has two twin daughters who she's taking care of. So, and she's a regular mom too, making muffins and going to soccer practice and volunteering in her classroom, trying to do the best she can.
You mentioned at the time you made the film, she had the son, Huntington's. I didn't realize it affected kids. I knew obviously you have a gene, but this is the only very young person in this movie who has this disease, and it manifests itself, it seemed, really differently than it does in adults, sort of more swift and horrible.
It's the acceleration is a lot faster, and the symptoms are a bit different in kids. Seizures are a big part of it, and then dystonia, which is hardness of the limbs, and it's very painful.
Have you gone back to revisit her and the other folks that you did film?
Well, the great thing is that at the screening of the film at the Seattle International Film Festival on the opening night and on the follow-up afternoon screening, we had four of the seven cast members, so to speak, at the film. And at the second screening, we also had Scott, the husband of Katie, who, as Liz had said, has advanced in his symptoms and was there in a wheelchair and watched the whole film and answered some questions from people afterwards. So it was a beautiful, round story.
The seventh person, as I mentioned, is a physician. He's, I believe, South African by birth and now lives in British Columbia. And he, I guess, after seeing all the stories, he's the person that provides a little bit of a path to action, if there is one that a normal non-medical person can take. And it got me to wondering, Liz, as executive producer of this, what do you want it to do? What do you want this film to achieve?
We would like this film to tell the story of Huntington's to people that don't know about it. We'd like to give people that are affected by Huntington's, who typically feel pretty isolated, a way to feel connected and supported and a way to share what they're going through. We'd love people to take some action. You know, one of the lines that Dr. Michael Hayden has in the film is that we're all playing our part. We all have a role in fixing this problem. So, you know, that can mean a lot of things, and whether it's raising money or awareness, understanding, compassion.
So, Josh, Liz mentioned, she sort of listed off at the beginning all the things that you had done, why she felt happy having you make this film. How did the experience of 5 years of your life making this impact the way you look at your profession?
It's been a dramatic series of revelations, really, for me as a filmmaker. You know, I, for the last 20 years, have been used to two-week schedules with huge deadlines, lots of big budget, you know, large crews, and lots of stress and lots of expectations and very monitored kinds of projects. And so this was just completely the opposite. It was untethered, it was open-ended, and it was up to me to, you know, find that initial direction and then work with all the people that helped make this film as good as it is. to establish a clear path. So it was just an incredible process, and the result on a daily basis of actually finishing the film brings joy and, you know, a sense of new perspective for me, mainly because, I learned that I actually have compassion, you know, that I can actually express compassion as a filmmaker, and that's pretty cool revelation to have.
That was Josh Taft. He's the Seattle-based director of the documentary film Alive and Well. We also talked with Liz Weber, who's the film's executive producer. Alive and Well is going to screen tomorrow, June the 12th at 7:15 in the evening. It's part of the Best of the Seattle International Film Festival, SIFF. Documentary was nominated for Best Documentary at the festival, and if you'd like to see it, you can buy tickets online at siff.net. This is Weekday. Trapped in your cup, I am all the days that you choose to
ignore. 9:33. Some thoughts on the purpose of life in a minute.
Hi, this is Jackie Lydon. You can count on KUOW and NPR to provide intelligent reporting that nurtures your knowledge. KUOW's programs take you beyond the headlines to give you a deeper understanding of important issues. Now is the best time to renew your annual KUOW membership or to make a special gift. Please mail your gift in today or give online at kuow.org. And thank you.
We got 12 bottles of water, 56 beers, 2 vodkas, 4 whiskey, 6 bottles of wine, tequila, Nutella, cheese, steaks, a Milky Way.
That's Seth Rogen in This Is the End, a parody of End of the World movies. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who co-wrote and co-directed the film and co-wrote Superbad. Join us.
That's tonight at 8 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. It's on HD radio and it's online at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Obstetrics. The UW Medicine Obstetrics program helps women have healthy pregnancies and healthy babies through its comprehensive family-based approach, including midwifery, lactation support, genetic counseling, or high-risk care. More information at uwmedicine.org/obstetrics.
-55 degrees in Seattle under a sky full of clouds. Forecast calls for clouds all day, continuing chance of showers, and a high of 65. 9:35. I'm Bernard Ouellette. What's in the Seattle Police Department's evidence warehouse? We're going to take a peek in 30 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Nearly a quarter of the world's population looks to the Quran for spiritual guidance. So what does the Quran say is the purpose of life? Joining us to talk about it is Imam Jamal Rahman. He's co-founder of Muslim Sufi Minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. He's the author of a new book, too, called Spiritual Gems of Islam. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, my honor and pleasure.
Do you want to lay out the whole subheading for us? I was going to shorten it.
Yes. Well, the book is called Spiritual Gems of Islam. And it has a long subtitle, I think for marketing purposes, Insights and Practices from the Quran, Hadith, Rumi, and Muslim Teaching Stories to Enlighten the Heart and Mind.
Yeah, it's quite a lot that you've undertaken with this book, and we're going to barely get to any of it.
Yes.
But you did start out the book talking about two metaphors that guide how you see life. And I was wondering if you could share them with us.
Yes, one of them is one of my favorite verses from the Quran, where God says that we have created the earth as a carpet so that you may walk upon it on spacious paths. So that has many levels of meaning. Meaning, one of our main purposes on earth is to really create an inner spaciousness within, so we can walk on spacious paths, be of authentic service. And the other metaphor is from the Hadith, which means a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, where he talks about polishing the heart, that there's a polish for every rust, and the polish for the rust of the heart is remembrance of God, which really means that you infuse yourself with divine qualities like compassion, awareness, forgiveness. And that's very hard, because polishing the heart can be inconvenient.
Well, difficult, at least, yes.
For example, Rumi says, you know, I'm amazed at the seeker of purity that when it comes time for polishing, complains of a rough handling.
Mm. Now, the heart, you point out in the book, is mentioned 130 times in the Quran.
132 times, actually.
132 times.
Yes.
Why so many? Why is the heart such a focus?
Well, you know, the Quran, like other holy books, says God is outside of you and inside of you. And there are many sayings, but there's one in particular that says that God cannot be contained in the space of the earth or in the heavens, but God can be contained in the space of the pure, loving heart of my servant. And so the goal of life is really to create a passageway from human heart to divine heart, to become a more evolved human being, to be fully developed, so one can really serve God's creation. And the way to do that is to create that inner spaciousness by opening up the heart.
Is that what the Quran's about in its essence? Is that what it says the purpose of life is?
Well, you know, the spiritual essence in the Quran is about several things. One is to transform the ego, and that has three stages. The next stage is to open up the heart, as you've mentioned, so that we can, as the Quran says, truly bring a heart turned in devotion to God. So yes, to answer your question, to open the heart so we can be more filled with inner spaciousness, be more inclusive, really be spacious in our serving of God's creation, is a major responsibility. The Quran says that God has appointed humanity of all religions to be God's vice regent on earth, to be God's ambassador, ambassadress upon earth.
Well, and the ego is a big problem, at least in this book.
Oh,
a lot
yes.
of it is dealing with how to get past our ego to have a deeper understanding of ourselves and the world.
Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was once asked about this work of inner spaciousness. He said, I can summarize it in two sentences. One is, know thyself, and you shall know thy sustainer. And the other one is, die before you die. And this is the difficult work of really becoming aware of our ego qualities. And then here's where the word jihad comes in, the most misunderstood word. The word jihad literally means effort. And the bulk of the meaning of jihad is about making this spiritual effort to transform our ego. So that, and the second sentence Prophet Muhammad said was, die before you die. So you can die to your false self before you die a physical death. But this is, as we have said many times, this is very, very inconvenient work. It requires a lot of effort, a lot of time, dedication, the support of a community. And this is the work we always want to avoid.
Why is that?
It's difficult. I would rather tell you, Katie, how to transform the ego. But for me to do it, it's a lifelong effort. And as the Quran says, the first stage is that the ego tends to be a commanding master. It is our work to transform it into a personal assistant. But that's just the first stage. Then you have to use all our awareness, our compassion for ourselves, to become aware that the ego, in working with the ego, we have choices. and to master that. And the third stage is to align the tamed ego with one's higher self. So three main stages, a lot of work, but that is our purpose. There's a wonderful revelation that came to the Prophet Muhammad in a dream where God said, I was a secret treasure and I longed to be known. And so I created you and the worlds, visible and invisible. And this is the whole meaning of Islam. Islam means to surrender in peace. And what are we surrendering? Surrendering our attachment to our ego. And sooner or later, maybe in some incidents or one major incident, we shall get in touch with this longing to get to know myself, to have a relationship with myself, to connect with something deeper. I begin to ask deeper questions. I want to live a more meaningful life. I want to evolve into the fullness of my being. That is when the Quran says, welcome, you have started the process of surrender.
Speaking with Imam Jamal Rahman about his new book, Spiritual Gems of Islam, what did you have to get over on your ego path when you were first starting your own way?
For me, I think, like many of us, I was full of excuses why I would not do this work or avoid the work. You know, there's a story using that archetype, mullah. And somebody knocks on the mullah's door wanting to borrow his donkey. And the mullah doesn't want to give the donkey, so he makes up an excuse. He lies. He says, oh, I wish you had come 5 minutes earlier. I just gave it to somebody. Somebody else is borrowing it. Unfortunately, just at that time, the donkey in the stable begins to bray. So he's caught. The neighbor says, but I hear your donkey. So mullah says, now who will you believe? You know, pretending to be angry. Will you believe me or the donkey? Excuses. So I am full of excuses. I will do this work. I'll do it at a more convenient time or tomorrow. And it's very critical that the time is now and the place is here. So for me, that was a major issue.
And how do you begin the work? Do you have to identify the things, the patterns that you're constantly getting into, or the things that, you know, if I'm have a hot temper or I tend to cry, do I have to identify what those things are within myself?
I think beyond even all of that, the Quran suggests that you have to become a seeker. Something has to awaken in you to want to become a better human being, to want to really be of service. Something shifts. And usually, and this is people who make commentaries on the Quran, usually the two veils between me and me becoming a seeker, that of health and wealth. My health is good. Health of my loved ones is okay. I have emotional security, financial security. Then all this talk of doing this work is very remote and very inconvenient, as we say. But should one of those veils shatter, somebody gets cancer, security gets dashed, broken, then we begin to ask deeper questions. What is going on? And I need help from a source higher than human personality. That is when I really make a commitment to what is called tawbah, or to turn. I beg repentance because I've been living in a robotic way. I've just been living a life of what is called a life of manageable depression. And now suddenly I realize, as I move, and this is from Islamic spirituality, I'm moving from a knowledge of the tongue to a knowledge of the heart. And I get in touch with this longing to make a deeper connection with the divinity within me, with the divinity outside of me, to want to become a better person, to be of authentic service. That's when it starts.
Do you think our culture allows that, generally speaking?
You mean, well, you know, I receive people all the time. Somebody comes and say, you know, is devastated because, say, of a divorce or a death in the family or suddenly no wealth at all, no job, nothing. And something awakens in them and they begin to realize that it starts with, I need help. And what has been theoretical in the past now becomes real. That my loved one has died. It's the end of my relationship. And they turn in a different direction, seeking meaning, seeking consolation, seeking practices to lift them out of this pain and this suffering. In a way, they're really turning in the direction of spirituality. I was a secret treasure, and I longed to be known. It's like we are digging deeper to connect with that longing for something higher and deeper.
I'm speaking with Imam Jamal Rahman. He is a co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. And we're talking about his new book, Spiritual Gems of Islam, which he'll be speaking about at the University Temple United Methodist Church, which is across from the UW bookstore, on June 12th at 7 p.m. I want to circle back to the mullah, because yes. You use that character throughout this book to explain different things. Explain to us who the mullah is.
Mullah is an imaginary character that Muslim teachers have used ever since Islam came into existence to convey some very critical teachings. Rather than sermonize, they just tell a story. For example, a very simple one. You know, the typical picture of the mullah is he's got a turban, he's middle-aged, he's got a beard, he's always on his donkey. And the pictures you see of him in many Muslim countries, a pictorial depiction, is he's rushing through the marketplace on his donkey. And when people hail him and say, "Mullah, I want to talk to you," he says, I'm sorry, I'm in a rush. I'm looking for my donkey." So it's like, aren't we all? So that conveys the state of affairs. I'm on my donkey and yet looking for my donkey.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it about him? Is it because he seems so flawed but yet so clever in the stories?
Because he is a village idiot. Because he's unassuming, he is very natural, he's authentic, is simple. He's very honest, very transparent. He's willing to laugh at his own mistakes and says things which sound silly, but really have a lot of meaning. For example, there's a very famous one about gratitude, where the mullah has lost his donkey. And that's a big deal in that part of the world. And the entire village tries to find the donkey. They cannot find the donkey. In the evening, they come to give mullah the bad news that his donkey is lost forever. And what's the mullah doing? He's in the town square on his knees saying, "Thank you, Allah. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful." So they say, "Mullah, you haven't heard the bad news. Your donkey is lost forever." He says, I know, but I'm so grateful, because imagine what could have happened to me if I was on the donkey." So this is actually a teaching about how beautiful, how majestic is this simple practice of gratitude, and particularly in times of affliction. If we're giving thanks in times of affliction, we're giving thanks for unknown blessings already on their way. No one knows whether he was ever born, but for sure in many Muslim countries there are graves of the mullah. And again, there's a teaching here. For example, in Turkey, there's a huge shrine of the mullah. And as you approach, there's a huge door to his tomb, which is padlocked and has chains around it. But there are no walls around that. And there's a great teaching there. And the great teaching, Rumi says, is no matter in this life, whatever it is you acquire, how many riches or how many plans you make, the thief will come from the unguarded side. Therefore, why don't you be occupied with that which is of essence, which can never be stolen? Love, compassion, forgiveness, awareness, service.
It seems like a lot of the different teachings, particularly with the mullah, but also things that you write about in this book, are about us not being able to see something that's right in front of us. It's almost like we have blinders on.
It's almost like we are overlooking the obvious. And there's the teaching after teaching about that and how we're looking for things in the wrong places. Probably the most famous story of the mullah is where he's looking for a lost key underneath this, under the light. In those days, there's no electricity. You had pillars with fire on it. And so he's looking for the key, his lost key, and his neighbors join him, and they cannot find the key. And they ask him, can you kind of tell us whereabouts you dropped it so we may better direct the search? He says, actually, I lost the key miles away inside my house. Then they say, why are you looking for it here? This is simple. My house has no light at all. There's so much more light here. Now, this story has gone all over the world. And this is really about how we're looking for solutions in our life. And it's just one level of meaning. Solutions in our life by focusing on that which is external. I have lost my happiness because of a failed relationship or a plan that didn't happen, didn't transpire. I spent all my energy in fixing this relationship, blaming this person, that person, you know, doing this, doing that. That's great. But the truth is, I didn't lose it out there. I lost it inside me, inside my house. And it's much more dim and dark there. So I'm overlooking the obvious. And yet, it is so subtle.
Imam Jamal Rahman, he's the author of a new book called The Spiritual Gems of Islam. And he is speaking June 12th at 7 p.m. at the University Temple United Methodist Church across the street from the University of Washington bookstore on 43rd Street in Seattle. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about this.
It is my honor and pleasure. Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell.
It is Tuesday, and we check in once again with Michael Fagan for a weather look and hike recommendation. Michael, you're down in Oregon today.
That's right, visiting some friends, not running away from the weather.
Is it sunny there?
Yes. There was a brief raindrop, but lots of blue sky right now. So the weather's a little nicer here than up in the Washington area. But today, the weather forecast for the Seattle region, we're looking at upper-level low moving in later today and increasing chance of rain for later this afternoon and for Wednesday and Thursday, and also a slight chance of an afternoon thunder shower in the mainly for the mountains for Wednesday and Thursday. High temperatures are going to be on the cool side, about 65, and then sun returns later on Friday and into Saturday. Now, our hike is Umtanum Ridge, which is north of Yakima. It's about an hour and a half drive from Bellevue, so not too bad. One of the highlights, and I was somewhat surprised to see there's still a lot of wildflowers out. So now's a great time to go the next week or so. And this week the temperatures will be on the cool side, which is good because it can get rather hot there usually this time of the year. You can also get some great views, Mount Stewart, Yakima Canyon. Best days for views, if you could sneak out today, that'd be great, or later on Friday and Saturday will also be some great views and nice weather. Now we have the Marcy scale of difficulty.
This is sort of a hard hike.
Yeah. So Green Lakes are 1 and Mount Si is 5. This is 3.8. Now, the reason it's 3.8, it's actually short distance. It's only 2.5 miles to get to the top of the ridge, but it's 2,200-foot gain. So there's parts that are steep. Now, you don't have to go all the way to the top. You still get some nice views going part way up. So you do want to make sure you have trekking poles coming down because it is steep. And, again, some great views. If you don't want to do the steep part of the trail, if you're looking for something that's more on the 1.5 scale of difficulty, just do the Umtanum Creek Canyon. That stays low and minimal elevation gain.
Now, there is one little caveat that you sent in an email. This is steep, but there are also rattlesnakes on this trail?
There can be. Now, and that's actually the case. I'm not trying to scare anyone off from this hike, but it's just it's a point of information on any of the hikes in eastern Washington. There are rattlesnakes. Now, it's important to realize rattlesnakes are rather shy. They like to hide so they don't become someone's lunch, a bird or another animal out there. So they want to be hiding. So it's actually a good idea on your hike. Make noise. probably scare them off. Now, we saw one snake on our hike. I wasn't sure exactly what type of snake it was. We didn't stick around to find out. We basically stopped and gave the snake space. It didn't move, so we went way around, and everything was fine. Now, I did put some pointers on my blog as far as what you do if you do run into a rattlesnake. Besides keeping your distance, it's a good idea to have hiking boots, long pants. And actually, if for some reason someone gets bit having a cell phone, to call for help, because you're not supposed to move if you get bit. You don't want the venom circulating. But again, this is, you know, the snakes probably won't be out, but you just should know about that. It's a possibility. And then finally, if you really want to get some exercise, you could sign up. I know, Marcy, you want to do this next year. They have a 25K or 50K run in the area. So
yes,
next April you could sign up for that. Mm-hmm. Now, for permit, you need a BLM pass. It's $5, and you can pay right at the trailhead. We don't have a Green Trails map for that. And I also wanted to make mention that Tuesday through Thursday, the Qualmie Pass is closed from 8 to 10 p.m., so you want to make a note of that.
Yes, you absolutely do. Well, Michael, thanks for sending us somewhere where the sun might be out. Umtanum Ridge, south of Yakima, about an hour and a half from Bellevue. And
excuse me, it's north. I'm sorry, I had a typo.
Okay, sorry. North of Yakima, still about an hour and a half drive from Bellevue. And it should be a little bit better weather-wise than we're going to see in the Puget Sound region. Michael Fagan, thank you for joining us on your little brief vacation. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Michael Fagan. Yep, we will. Michael Fagan's with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, gives us some good hikes to match the weekend weather forecast. And now, the sound of the day. That is somebody who is a really good listener. It's Gabriel, who is skiing up South Sister, which is a peak in the Three Sisters Wilderness in Oregon. And his skis have removable traction devices that are called skins. And what you're hearing is the friction of the skin sliding on the wet corn snow, like a little zippery sound. The phonographers would have really liked that yesterday. We want to know what you're listening to. Record 30 seconds of the sound that you hear around you and send that to us, along with the story behind your sound. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. And please include sound of the day in your subject line. Coming up in the next hour on our show, we're going to hear about the evidence room in the Seattle Police Station, Green Days Gardening, and Jarek Hoffer, a.k.a. Jinx Monsoon, joins us.
/9:59 President Obama is calling on Congress to pass the immigration bill currently under consideration. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival, presenting our 11th hour, straight talk on climate change from people who know, June 15th at Seattle Rep, with climate scientists Kevin Trenberth and Richard Alley and journalist Andrew Revkin. Performance by Seattle Opera. More at seattlesciencefestival.org.
What do stories tell us about who we are?
We all want affirmations that our lives have